Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. You got me to eat head cheese.
Oh, and it was good. You know it.
It was good, but it was because you sliced it so thinly.
And then I put it on a warm plate.
Yes.
So it was like hot pig jello.
Again, this week, our guest is my old running partner, Mario Batali. Chef restaurateur, co-owner of 26 restaurants all over the world, one of the Emmy Award-winning hosts of The Chew as well. How did TV get into the mix? Because I remember this young, ambitious, unbelievably talented chef, restaurateur.
Thank you, my friend.
And then the Food Network was just starting. You know, how did that happen?
So I know that you'll remember the old Meals on Wheels events that we used to do at Rock Center. And it was with my wife's company, the Coach Farm Goat Cheese, that I would go on these Mondays. Because I believe Mondays was our closed day at a certain point at Poe. And I met a guy named Jonathan Lynn, who at that point was the developer of talent at the Food Network. And he was a little guy, nice guy with a bow tie. And he said, "Hey, how'd you like to be on TV?" And I'm looking at him like, "What the hell is going on here?" And I'm like, "What do you mean TV?" He said, "There's a new thing on called the Food Network." And I'm like, "Hey, I heard of it. That's where that guy Emeril's on, right?" And he said, "Yeah, we'd love to come in and audition for a show." I'm like, "Well, what do I got to lose? Let me see." So I went in. We did a Ready, Set, Cook with Sissy Biggers.
I remember that.
I had a really good time. I don't remember if I won or lost, but I feel that if they wanted me to come back, I must have won, or I must have at least looked like I could talk coherently in front of a camera. I came back and I did a couple other shows.
Oh, remember they had Chef du jour.
Chef du jour. That's exactly right. Where you walk in there and—
That was their tryout.
Right, that was their tryout. So you did five of those shows in 1 or 2 days, and then they'd see if they felt like offering you a show. And after a couple of those, they said, "How'd you like to do a show? We want to call it Molto Mario." I went in and met with Reese Schoenfeld, who's the kind of developer, the president, right? He kind of invented the whole thing. He came from CNN. He imagined that the Food Network would be like CNN. The background wouldn't change very much. You'd just roll in a new stove and a new cook, and it would be kind of this interesting consumable product. And it just started that way. And I started probably in the end of 94. So Poe had been open a year and a half. And I started doing these shows. And I would do the shows in the morning. And we could do up to six, and then I'd go to work, and we'd open for dinner, and then we'd move along.
You have an insane work ethic, dude.
So I would do 65 shows in 2 weeks. And
cook
every night at the restaurant. And then we'd, you know, then we wouldn't make shows for another 2 or 3 months. Then we'd come back in and do 65 more shows. And it was exciting because all of a sudden people say, "Aren't you the guy on TV?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's me. Come on to my restaurant." And that's when the reservations started kind of rolling in a little bit heavier. We were already pretty busy.
But I remember you told me that it was only after you started being on TV did you do the lunch business that you wanted.
Well, that's when we opened for lunch. After I started figuring out that this TV business was going to draw, all of a sudden we could do, you know, two turns at lunch almost every day. And we could really add and be sure that on whatever, Tuesdays, and particularly Saturdays and Sundays, we would be absolutely packed the moment we opened at 5.
Right.
Like, there was not a seat. From 5 to 5:05, the room was full.
Wow.
Which was a great little thing.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a hell of a soapbox, and I was lucky enough to have it, and I look back at those days as crazy. I'm not sure I would do it exactly the same, but, I mean, it worked out really well for me and my partner, and we had a great ride, and the Food Network did a lot to help build the legitimacy of a lot of interesting people's careers. And I believe I gave them a little bit of legitimacy, and that my food and my thoughts were always part of what was probably considered slightly over-intellectual at that time.
Right.
But still not didactic and annoying. And I had my own little bit.
But, you know, you say you might not have done it the same way. You know, it's the same with any new thing. It's like when I started Serious Eats, did I know it was going to be 24/7 constant stress? You know, you would always say, "Oh, you'll be fine.
Did you
don't
know
worry.
That the internets were going to be popular?"
Right. Did I know that the – exactly. And it was just like there is no linear course. There's no path. It's the path that you make.
Right.
You know, it's not like becoming a lawyer or a doctor.
No, because there's no strict – there's no like, this is the road. Follow this path and you'll get to a certain level of success.
So after Poe came Babbo, which – I always tell you, you know, does have the greatest energy of any restaurant I've ever walked into. Used to say, "Yeah, I don't know what it is. It was everything. It was the food, obviously. It was your cooking, Andy's cooking, Gina De Palma, the late Gina De Palma, whom we both revere and adore. And
Joe Bastianich.
And Joe Bastianich.
In the front
so
of the house.
On a partner.
Right.
So what was that about? I remember looking at the space with you and Susie, and like Susie's like, Mario's going to take on a partner, you know, and it's like, and Mario's like, yeah, I think this is a good idea. You said this is a,
Well, we had become really good friends because he had worked at Becco.
Right.
He developed an open Becco, but he also had worked at Felidia his whole life. And her earlier restaurant called Buona Via, he was a busboy when he was in high school or most of his life. And his mom introduced us at one of the James Beard Journalist Awards that she was somehow overseeing. And we became fast friends because he was expediting and I was cooking. And for some strange reason, we just enjoyed each other's company, and we do to this day. And it was a very interesting partnership in that I really respected his point of view on both the kitchen aspects, as well as letting him kind of run the front of the house. And we both kind of bled into each other's character. But I remember when we were tasting the menu, we both looked at each other and I trusted his opinion when he said, this tastes like, you know, you made it out of something left over in the walk-in. And this is going to be a destination restaurant. You should definitely use first-use products on all the things on this menu. And then we'll work on the other secondary stuff, because I was going to use porcini stems for something. And it turned out it was wise and sage advice. So we developed Babbo together, and it was an ultimate collaboration on just about everything and how we designed the room.
But you're very different people.
Oh, completely different. No, and that's, I think, what, you know, you don't always, your best friend is very rarely like exactly like you. And for a long time, we really just collaborated in such an interesting way that Babbo, Lupa, Esca, Otto, Casamono, Barjamon, Spotted Pig, Del Posto, you know, on and on and on. We built these great restaurants, not because we had this manifest destiny to continue to build profitable and inspired restaurants, but because every next step, we opened a restaurant because we had talented people in each of the restaurants that would have gone to work for somebody else had we not offered them the opportunity to work alongside with us as in some way a partner.
So what you shared was a vision of how the business could grow.
Right, exactly.
And is it because you realize that managerial functions are almost completely separate from an ability to cook?
No, because I expect the chef to be able to manage both the staff in the kitchen as well as understand and be able to manipulate and use the financial information to our profit. So I hold them accountable for the food costs. But it's not that I just expect them to do that. I teach them how to do it.
Right.
And I teach them how we do it in our way. So from Babbo, Andy and Mark Ladner, for example, the reason we opened Lupa next is because Mark Ladner was the sous chef for Andy Nusser. And he was clearly as talented. And there was just no other job for him at Babbo anymore. So instead of letting him go work for Drew Nieperon or Danny Meyer or somebody else, we built Lupa, and he became a partner in Lupa. And Otto, we had Zach Allen. Zach Allen was this fantastic guy that started at Lupa with our charcuterie and salumi program and became so talented that we built Otto to keep him in line.
So you were a chef A&R man.
Yes, exactly. But I saw all this talent. But, I mean, we developed it. I could tell at that point by looking in someone's eyes for 15 minutes during a conversation whether they were going to be able to work with me or not, because they had a fire. But they also had a desire not only to be a good cook, but because they wanted to be a business person. And so all of these people have become business people in their own light. And the list goes on. And the people that have come through my world and moved on, like Mario Carbone or Nick over at Maialino, like these are guys that I helped train. And then they've achieved their own greatness because maybe they had a seed, but they had their own seeds.
And there's no envy or jealousy. I've talked to them both. You know, they regard you as a mentor still.
Well, because I would loan them money or hold their hand or whatever they wanted to do. Like, I'm happy that people leave. You can't keep all these people. And it used to be that when someone would quit, I would hold a grudge. And I realized, man, this is going to be a long list. So if someone leaves to go open their own place, I am ecstatic because I think that's their ultimate thing. And I always tell them, if you need help or if you decide you don't like this, come back and work for me again. But if you need any advice or any help or, you know, if you don't understand the linen purchase or you don't understand how they scam you in the linen world, come tell me. Come talk to me and I'll tell you how you don't end up with 1,600 extra napkins that you paid for at the end of the week. Because, you know, it just... just happens that way. And there's ways that money just slips out of your hand, and it shouldn't. And you just have to monitor a lot of the things. You have to watch all the things come in. You have to watch all the things go out. You have to know how much a mop costs, how much a gallon of bleach costs. You have to know how much your late-night cleaning guys are getting paid and how accountable they are to the time frame. And you just have to develop a large vision of understanding how much things cost, in addition to already knowing how to cook really well and to put your line together so that you can put the food out on time.
Yeah. You also became famous at Babbo for selling every part of every ingredient. What was your famous line? We take stuff.
We buy stuff. We fix it up. And we sell it for profit. And as long as you guys all understand that part of our business, then we are going to be successful. But if we buy stuff, fix it up, and throw it away, or we buy stuff and we just eat it, then we're never going to make any money. So understand that when you buy, like, when you buy a whole shoulder of a pig, every part of it, or when you buy the pig's head because you really want those cheeks or you want to make testa, use every part of it, including the bones of that head, after you've roasted it to take all of the meat off the face so you can make head cheese. Take that bone and make a deep, rich broth that we can put it on another piece.
You got me to eat head cheese.
Oh, and it was good. You know it.
It was good, but it was because you sliced it so thinly.
And then I put it on a warm plate.
Yes.
So it was like hot pig jello.
It was hot pig jello.
But it also had very acidic components to it. Like, we did the pickled pearl onions on that, which made it not seem like you were just eating these leftover bits. It was more like we were celebrating the rich unctuousness of that porcine magnificence. But we pickled it, other stuff around it, so that we kind of lured you in with the pickles.
You just fooled us all.
We didn't fool you. No, but I told you what it was.
Yes.
Right. So, yes. I mean, you know, like, we became relatively renowned for using all of the odd bits. But, I mean, that is by no means anything innovative in the Italian culture.
No. Or
you wouldn't
in
kill
other
a pig.
Cultures.
In any culture. Any real culture.
In China.
In China. In South America. In any part where people actually live close to the soil and actually have farm animals, they would never kill the pig and eat the pork chops and throw the rest away. That would be the most stupid thing you've ever heard. And it also wouldn't respect the life of that animal.
Right.
Nor the work and time that you put into it. So, of course, using the pig's ears and using the trotters and using the tail and using everything like that. I mean, not every one of my dishes was a hit. I remember I did a pig's ear salad back then and no one loved it. Now April's killing it with her pig's ear salad at the pig because it's so good, because she was smart enough to confit it before she fried it. So it's 10 times better than the one I made.
I remember you told me when you were selling, was it lardo or guanciale? It's like, you told your servers it was white prosciutto.
Prosciutto bianco. Tell them this is prosciutto bianco. Pig's fat from the neck. But when you tasted it, because it had been done right, the flavor was so intense. And there was the rosemary and the garlic in the background. But because we were buying those beautiful pigs from that lady in Vermont, or we were buying these magnificent pigs from around here from the Heritage Group, the fat was so delicious. And you could taste that it had eaten acorns. And you could taste what it had eaten in every part of its diet. And that it had been raised right and was never frightened and was never tortured or treated poorly. That taste was so evident on the plate that when you picked it up, you're like, wow, this is so delicious, because no one had ever taught you that eating just a tablespoon of fat was good. You'd always taste, you would taste hollandaise, which is a tablespoon of fat.
Right.
You would taste
McDonald's,
vinaigrette.
McDonald's French fries used to be fried
in beef tallow. Beef tallow, remember? When India sued them?
Yes.
The entire country sued
exactly.
them?
Exactly. Very Trumpian.
Yes, exactly.
So let's talk about Heat, which I think is perhaps the greatest book ever written about cooking and life in a kitchen.
First of all, let's talk. Did you ever read Amongst the Thugs?
No.
Bill Buford's book on soccer hooligans.
Oh, it's supposed to be amazing.
It is amazing. It is twice as visceral and 10 times more interesting than the book he wrote about me. But that said, yes, the book is very interesting.
The book is interesting. You know, you knew him. He said he was going to write a book. You gave him creative freedom. You gave him an all-access pass to your kitchens.
I would never do that again.
Yes. That's my question.
Right.
Would you do – in retrospect, was that too much access?
Yes. Of course it was. I mean, there was just stuff that, you know, whatever. Bill built his story. Bill is a thoughtful and creative artist. He is a writer of the most. But I was talking too much. I shouldn't have had that much to say. I shouldn't have shared as much information about my Italian family and friends to the point that they won't talk to me anymore.
Right.
Like, so I lost a family.
Yeah.
But that wasn't Bill's problem. That was my problem. I talked too much. Bill just recorded stuff. He knew what questions to ask. He knew what position to get me into that I felt like I was filling out the story, and subsequently it became an interesting book. I hope one day it'll be made into a movie because it's fantastic.
It's been optioned a zillion times.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. And, you know, I don't cry over it. And as much as the first time I read it, I'm like a little sick to my stomach because it was just like standing naked in a room full of mirrors with all the lights turned on very bright. It's like, yes, man, did I really want to look at me like that? And at the end, it's slightly flattering. It's still raw a little bit, so it's all right. Yeah. I mean, you know, he wrote a great book, and there are some very proud moments in there for everyone on my team. And there's some embarrassing and stupid moments because that's what you get when you let someone do a biography on you.
So let's talk about Eataly, which came out of nowhere and has become in New York, someone told me the fourth biggest tourist attraction after the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, and 9/11?
Met. No, and the Met.
And the Met.
Well, I'm sure 9/11's beating it now, so I'm sure we're five.
You're five.
Yeah.
But I remember when you and I talked about this, and I was like, okay, well, this sounds good. It's like an Italian food theme park, and you and Joe got very involved, right. And I wondered if, like, would people take to this? And my God, was I wrong?
No, you weren't wrong. We were all tentative. You hadn't gone with me to the original Torino store and saw what I saw, which was a temple to Italian gastronomy. And what they did so well and what they continue to do so well is they bring products to the Eataly store that you can't get anywhere else. Like, even in Italy, some of these products are exclusive. Some of these cheeses, some of these pastas are made by them. Like, it's a triple dip. They own the wheat field, they own the pasta production facility, and they own the distribution.
Yeah.
Like, they're just really smart guys because they really know what they want.
Yeah, they
know. And they really understand.
There's a very singular vision.
Right, and it's very slow food. It's about biodiversity, and it's about the uniqueness of each individual acre of land all throughout Italy.
Yeah.
So when you go to these stores in Italy, first of all, there's three or four great ones and a bunch that I don't really love because they're just smaller versions because they want to put them in a city and they want to have a lot. But when you go to the Torino one or the Milano one, which is in this fantastic old theater, or you go to the Roman one, which is three times bigger than the one in New York, they're just fantastic. And then they come here and we work together and we created, Joe and I and the Eataly team along with the Saper brothers, we created these interesting restaurant concepts that are a little bit more elaborate, a little bit trickier, but not tricked. You know, like when you go to the vegetarian restaurant or the vegetable restaurant, it's not some vegan heaven or some weird temple. It's just vegetables as Italians really enjoy them.
But it's fascinating because you developed it here, at least, almost as an online community, except it was offline. Like,
right.
It's become a gathering place. It's become what that famous sociologist calls the third place,
right,
where people gather besides work and home.
Right. And I think its success is that you can walk in there for free. You can walk in there and have a coffee. You can walk in the morning and have a coffee and come back for lunch and then go back later on for gelato. It's as almost as if, for a lot of people, someone dropped a little Italian town on 23rd and Broadway.
Yeah.
And you feel that when you walk in there, and there's the bakery. The beauty is that you can't get everything in every place. And I think that serves a lot of reference to allow you to understand that when you're in the fish restaurant, you're in the fish restaurant. And it's really in support of the fish store.
Sure.
Like, it's not some giant restaurant where you can get everything everywhere. Like, if you want to eat fish, you go to the fish restaurant. You want to eat the vegetables. If you want to eat pizza and pasta, you go to the pizza and pasta restaurant. You can't get dessert in any of those restaurants. You go to the gelato corner.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you go to the coffee bar.
Sure.
You go to the pastry shop, which makes it feel, at first, everyone's like, that's not going to work. And then everyone realizes that's what allows it to have an identity beyond some giant mall.
Yes.
Which is a food court.
Interesting.
Or a museum restaurant
where you can
have everything anywhere in a giant court.
Yeah. You are a chef and restaurateur who has made it a point to give back to the community in a big way. First of all, tell us a little bit about your foundation, which is now quite active, right?
Yes. The Mario Batali Foundation, I founded 7 years ago. And it was fundamentally because it occurred to me that in the prior 8 years, we gave to a lot of people, and during times of stress or when any of your customers are doing a fundraiser for their pet project or whatever it happens to be, whether it's their brass band in their hometown or children's hunger relief in Somalia or their book fent that they're doing somewhere else, it occurred to me that I was giving out things that more or less brought $500,000 or $600,000 a year to some groups of people. But there was no function. There was no strategy. There was no apparent angle. There was no focus on it.
Just a bunch of events.
A bunch of really nice events that were organized by nice people that I had somehow met, and somehow it enticed me to participate in their
work. Sure.
And that was all good. I realized at a certain point that I should start to think about using my brand for a specific focus. And what I thought that was to me, and still is to me, the most important thing that we squander in America is the potential of our children. And when you say children, it's like, yeah, whatever, the children this, the children that. Yeah, let's do it for the children. That's so trite. It's for me, it's about giving children in America the opportunity. And what are the three things that I think are the most significant that are often overlooked? First of all, children's hunger relief. 1 in 5 children in America goes to bed hungry. 1 in 5. That is such a preposterous number in the richest time in the richest
Tom
country
Colicchio's
of all time.
I know. Tom Colicchio's been on the show.
Yeah, of course. We feel the same way. And we work in different angles and in different fields. But the idea, first of all, that there are hungry children in America, and that also, that we raise enough food in America to feed North, Central, and South America every day, and we throw 42% of our product away every day. Like, there's got to be a way to incentivize the people that are throwing these products away to bring them somehow to market so that we can use them or give them away.
You're just taking what you put into Babbo on a really big scale.
Right, exactly. But it's also, we have to use the free market system and incentivize people. They're not just going to do it because it feels good. They're going to do it because they make $1 a pound or a penny a ton, whatever. So we have to figure that out. The second one is literacy guarantee. There is still 11% of children in America that are semi-illiterate by the time they graduate high school, if they graduate high school, which is preposterous. If you can't read, how can you possibly be successful in life?
Wow.
And then disease research. We have no intention of curing all disease or any disease. What I do is when some of my friends or any of my friends have a child who's gotten some affliction and they ask me to participate in some way in some of the research, and these are small grants, $25,000 to $100,000, they get something started in something like neuroblastoma,
right,
or a particular process in the kidney that doesn't allow people to process protein.
You're a foundation VC.
Right, exactly. But we just give small amounts, and that's their beginning of them getting going. And what it does for my friends is it helps them feel like they're participating in some small way to fixing or helping the system that has somehow decided how their children are going to be able to react. So we're not curing anything. And we raise about $1 million or $1.2 million every year. And we give it away, all of it, every year. And that's what we do. It's never going to be, Michael J. Fox raising, $700 million
right. But it's very
for Parkinson's.
But you also have very little overhead.
Right, exactly. No overhead. We have two employees, and they work for me on other levels. So as much as we'd like to be Michael J. Fox and really use that powerful vehicle that he does and actually change, he moved the needle in a big way. We're not necessarily that because I don't want this to become another business. I'm all right with it. I got a lot of things going on. It just makes us feel really good, and my team gets to participate. And anybody that wants to can participate in our little world and come to our little events. And it's a feel-good thing as much as also allowing all of my team players and all of my, 2,500 employees in all of my restaurants to somehow be a part of something that's beyond just the work there. And we encourage them to do everything that they want with everybody else's foundation,
right,
too. It's not like you only work with us.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. So let's talk about the most recent book, which is Mario Batali's Big American Cookbook.
Yes.
Which, by the way, is heavy, dude.
Oh,
can
yeah.
I say that? It weighs as much as Kenji's book, and his is 910 pages.
Yeah, I use thicker paper.
I know.
But his book is fantastic and probably worth more than mine. But still, this is almost a 5-pound book, 4.4 pounds.
His book is fantastic. This book is pretty interesting because it was your first foray. I mean, you and I have tasted a lot of American food together.
Yes, we have. We've actually eaten a lot of it, too,
We've eaten
Ed.
A lot
Let's
of it.
Let's not lie to these people.
But
we've eaten the whole plate sometimes, Ed, all right?
But this was a really an exploration of indigenous American food culture.
Correct.
So how did you go about doing it?
Well, as I've been traveling around the country for the last 18 years, shilling my Italian books and doing book tours or events where I go and raise money for another
right.
charity
You're on
or
the road
do
a fair amount.
Right. Or I'm at the Miami Food and Wine Festival or the Scottsdale Phoenix Food and Wine Festival or the, Eastern Washington State Hop Festival, wherever I happen to go. Whenever I'm in town, I'm always interested in finding out what the local delicacy is and who's making it and where I can find the best one. And what I found is as you travel around, all of these great stories generally get back to some kind of an immigrant story where some of the families who started there brought their dish from whether it was the Czech Republic or a particular province in China or a small town in Mexico or South America or anywhere
Russia
in the world.
Or,
right, yeah. Exactly. And they've brought one family arrived there and they found that they could thrive and another group of families came and all of a sudden there's a small community, whether it's 100 people or, you know, 10 or 15,000.
Right, and then some home cook opens a restaurant to so that those people have a place to go
right,
eat.
Right, right. And so then all of a sudden there's a great place to eat pierogies in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Or in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Or, you know, sauerkraut soup in, you know, somewhere else in the upper Midwest or Cajun food as it kind of became somewhere else in New Orleans or the food of the Southwest kind of represents kind of the Texas feel and the chilies and the local vegetables and kind of the use of the beef with some kind of culture from either Mexico or Central America.
Yeah.
And when you're eating food in Arizona, it's not like it was indigenous to the Native Americans there. It was kind of the food that developed kind of on the trail as America steamed westward as we expanded. So there's all kinds of things, including the Pacific Northwest. I kind of divided America into 8 separate regions and kind of tried to capture these simple dishes that you might taste in a greasy spoon or at someone's house or in a diner or at a state fair and find out how to make it. And I didn't ask anybody for the recipe. I just talked to them about it. And then eventually I kind of wrote them down and tested them and worked with them so that it tasted like exactly the simplest dish. I didn't try to Mario-ize it. I didn't jack it up with chilies or lime like I generally do with just about everything I cook at my house because I'm always looking for that extra pound. But I captured dishes. And generally what I would always ask people, I said, listen, if you leave your town for 6 months or a year and you come back, what's the first thing you want to eat?
Yeah.
And that tells me what they think of the dish that's of the most significance in their town.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So that's how I kind of assembled this. And we had 1,000 recipes to start with.
Wow.
And I decided I wanted to be able to shop for this. This is my most shoppable book because
right. All
of my Italian books, you have to bring in Bottarga from some little place in Sicily.
Right, or get
this
it
kind
online.
Of salt. Or, right, exactly. I mean, all of it you got online. But this particular olive oil or this particular kind of mushroom or this kind of pasta or this kind of cheese, like you had to really kind of get
right.
it. To make it right.
And this is gold medal flour.
Right. This is gold medal. Right. This is AP flour from America. Right. This is, you know, this is a canned cream of mushroom soup in some of the, you know, in the casseroles.
Right.
Like
sure.
it's okay. It's not by any means gourmet, but it is all delicious and authentic. So the dishes kind of all come together and they really kind of sing the song of the immigrant culture and the fabric that is America as it's developed kind of its own gastronomic soul in the last 150 years.
Yeah. That's so cool. You talked about the time you spent in Spain. You opened Casa Mono with Andy Nusser. And now you've just opened another tapas bar
yes.
at La Serena.
Yes.
So what fascinates you about tapas?
Having spent high school there, I've always loved kind of the Spanish way with small plates and the kind of conviviality of not salty, but savory food in a way that it's small portions. I mean, tapas comes from that you would put the little plate on top of your glass if you were going to walk away from the bar
right.
for a second so that the flies wouldn't go in or nothing would bother it. So it's a tapadera or a tapa. It's a small plate of something interesting. And we've kind of taken it, as has Spain, taken their food into slightly avant-garde, but nothing that's unrecognizable. But like there's sea urchins. And I mean, you know, there's berberechos. There's these kind of clams that I'm really fond of. There's interesting mushrooms, but there's also like things that you would recognize, like a tortilla or like the jamón, the famous Spanish ham, or the interesting cheeses based on sheep's milk cheeses called manchego. It's just a very simple thing. And we're actually going to take the dining room and kind of 50-50 at Spanish
really?
And modern Spanish and Italian food.
And you're taking the executive chef from Casa Mono.
Yes. Anthony Sasso is now working with us as the executive chef of the restaurant with Josh Lorano, who's the executive chef and partner of the hotel
Got
restaurants
it.
With us. And we're working together to kind of make this interesting, thoughtful, what I think, exciting hybrid of Spanish and Italian food that makes me really, really jazzed.
Yeah. That sounds so cool, man. I can't wait to go. So now it's time for the special sauce buffet.
Okay.
I know you're not thrown by anything. You shouldn't be thrown by any of these things. But I can't wait for your answers because I know you're going to have some really cool ones. So who's at your last supper, no family allowed, and no one that you already know?
Could
do
they
be
have
living
to be alive?
Dead? No. No.
Okay.
No.
How many people do I get?
4.
Last supper. Thomas Jefferson. Richard Brautigan. Jimi Hendrix. And Jim Harrison.
Can I come?
Yes, of course. You and I can prep.
All right. We
All
can
right?
prep.
That would be a good group.
That would be.
But I mean, I could come up with 10
group.
Groups like that. I mean, you know what? Because there's so many fascinating people that so many people have done so many interesting things that have driven me crazy with desire.
Like
to
if you had
hang
to do
an
all women's one, four women, who would you choose?
Madame Curie.
Okay.
Joan of Arc.
Okay.
Elizabeth Taylor.
Okay.
And Angelina Jolie. All hot.
Again,
no question, all hot.
I will prep for free.
Exactly.
I will prep for free. So what are you eating?
Well, as I say, if it's my last supper, the food is very insignificant compared to the company.
Right.
But, you know, given my choices, I am generally enjoying some of my favorite things would be, there'd be themes. For the first one, I would have, with the men, I would have game birds hunted by Jim. I would have Dungeness crab picked out by Richard Brodigan. I would have LSD soup made by Jimi Hendrix. And that would make it a long, long meal. And I would have some kind of interesting Concord grape dessert for Mr. Jefferson.
Excellent. I love that.
For the ladies, I would probably have some kind of an Amalfi seafood style. Start with a lychee marinati, linguine or spaghetti with any kind of seafood that comes there, a whole grilled turbo rombo, and maybe a panna cotta with some delicious lemon something.
So what do you cook when there's not much in your house to work with? Like, if you're coming home and everybody's asleep, although I guess your son's off to college now.
It's so an empty house.
what's the kind of thing that you would whip up?
A go-to snack for me is I take a half an onion, a jalapeno or a serrano chili. I saute it in the pan. I splash in a little already made spaghetti sauce. Not that I'm whipping up marinara, but I have my own brands.
Right.
I use that because it's delicious. I bring that up to a boil. I crack two eggs into that. Spicy tomato sauce, poaching eggs in there, and a piece of toast or a tortilla for something called eggs in hell.
So like, it's for me, it's
like right, exactly. Same thing, but a little spicier. For me, that takes like 5 minutes. It's not really complicated.
It's true. It's so easy.
Right.
And you're right. I've used jarred. I've
right.
used your jarred
sauce. Fantastic
sauce. It's perfect.
Right.
It's perfect.
That said, if it's truffle season, I always have duck eggs in the house, and I'll do a sunny side or an over-easy duck egg with a piece of fontina on it and white truffles, and I will giggle into the night for the rest of my days, thinking, not only am I lucky enough, but I can also get these things free from my restaurant.
So what are your guilty pleasures? Do you have any?
I feel no guilt about all my pleasure.
That's good.
But that said, I like a jacked Dorito.
Okay.
And I like it with like a tomatillo salsa that could be made by the Hatch Chili Company, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, it is fantastic. So who's the one person that if you could have the opportunity to sit down with and break bread and just see how their mind works and how they think about the world, again, living or dead, artist, singer. And I know you know a lot of people that other people have mentioned,
right.
But can't use any of those. Like you can't use Bono, you know, you can't use any of your friends.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, the first one I would say is I would like to be right now down there on Necker Island with President Obama, ex-President Obama.
Right.
Because that cat was so cool. And I would just like to see what he's thinking.
Yeah.
And where he's going and his advice for all of us during what's going to be a crazy time.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, this is a time when it's going to be strange. But imagine during the first 10 presidencies that democracy, it must have felt the same. We had no idea where we were going. We weren't sure what this was going to turn out to be. And all I can say is you must bring light into the darkness. You must bring courage into the room of fear, and you must stand up and be a part of the system, because since the Cuban Missile Crisis, I don't think anyone in America has felt any challenge.
Yeah.
And now we feel a little challenged, whether you're on either side. We don't know what's going to happen. I don't feel like I'm on either side. I'm just trying to figure out what the heck we're going to do. And I think participation is the answer.
Yeah, because you're right. For the first time, we are actually worried about the future of the Republic.
Exactly. Yeah. That said, also Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway.
I would have loved to hung out with that guy because his writing just drove me crazy. And as much as there was some macho stuff to it, his words and the way that he worked and the way that I know that he had appetites was something that was so amazing. I would have loved to be a part of his world.
So it's just been declared all over the world, Mario Batali Day. What's happening on that day?
Well, hopefully everybody's going to take off their long pants. They're going to put on flip-flops or Crocs. They're not going to work today. They're going to have their whole family home. They're going to get together. It's going to also coincide with National Gnocchi Day. And everyone is going to...
Which we've just declared.
Exactly. And everyone is going to hand-make pasta at their house and eat it together at lunchtime and spend the afternoon with their entire family eating, enjoying, and having a glass or two of wine.
That sounds awesome. Well, my friend, this has been fantastic.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Mario. And all, you know, we've known each other, what, longer than 20 years?
22 years.
Right? Go to his restaurants, 26 and counting, I think.
Yes, sir.
Including the tapas bar at La Serena.
Yeah.
Support the foundation, which is called
the Mario Batali Foundation.
.org.
If you're looking for it.
Which does amazing things. Watch The Chew, which we didn't even get a chance to talk about. And check out his newest book, Mario Batali's Big American Cookbook. Always great to see you, and we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.
Thank you very much.